quite sincerely, it's a delight to see you again. And to Murray Finley, thank you, Murray, for your sponsorship here, your co-chairmanship of co-person, I gotta get my titles fixed out right these days, and for the splendid reception and dinner that has been accorded us tonight by the National Committee for Full Employment. And I pay my respects to all of our esteemed colleagues from Congress that are here tonight. We're people of different political views, but we're deeply concerned about what's happening in our country. And I want this audience to know that while I have my regular bouts with Dr. Burns and Dr. Greenspan, that I cherish their friendship. We pray for each other. We work together. We seek answers together. And in the give and take of the discussion and debate, believe it or not, I think we make some progress. So tonight I'm just as happy as I can be. I didn't say pleased as much, but as happy as I can be to share this platform. Now, I've already been warned by my friend I.W. Abel, and I kept time on you two. And just one thing I'll promise you, I'll get you out of here before Saturday. Other than that, I make no commitments. I see my friend Bud Brown over here, and he doesn't believe me. You see, Congressman Brown is the ranking Republican member of the committee, and he has to put up with me all the time. The one time that we agree is when we present our budget, and I think that we've had a very good relationship. And next year, I'm confident that this chair of this committee will be chaired by one of the great congressmen of our country, and that's Dick Boley. You see, we all need to be House and Senate. Leon, it's good to see you. You're a warrior in the battle for economic and social justice, and I want to pay my respects to you tonight. Thank you very much. Well, we've had quite a party these last couple of days. During its 30 years of history, and that's no small period of time, the Joint Economic Committee has been very fortunate in having some outstanding leadership. And let me just recall for your memory some of those that have given us leadership. The first chairman of the Joint Economic Committee was the late and distinguished Senator from Ohio, Senator Robert Taft Sr. And then there was Senator Joseph Hawani of Wyoming. Men of different persuasion politically, but both powerful senators and men of conviction. Then our beloved friend, Senator Paul Douglas, great and wonderful human being. If I were to select someone from my experiences in Congress that both Muriel and I could say we truly love, it's Paul. Paul and Emily are two of our dearest friends. And then there's William Proxmire, Bill Proxmire. They've done so much to establish the reputation of the committee as an institution which could consistently provide thoroughly professional economic advice, and at the same time, the dialogue and the controversy which is so necessary to refine and discover truth, or at least issues. But none of these men could have accomplished what they did without the assistance of a truly talented and dedicated staff. Again, the committee has been most fortunate in consistently obtaining excellent staff and excellent staff leadership. And I want to single out tonight one man who is here with us. John Stark has been executive director of the committee since January 1967. During my year and 2 months, it seems a lot longer when I look back over it, as the chairman of the Joint Economic Committee, I have marveled at the quantity and quality of the work which the committee staff under John Stark's leadership has been able to produce for us. It's really something to behold. Now, there's seldom an appropriate opportunity for a member of Congress or one of us that serves momentarily as a chairman in our busy schedules to express properly our gratitude. So I interrupt my regular proceedings tonight on behalf of all the members of the Joint Economic Committee. And I am very pleased to be able to present to John Stark, if he'll come up here. John, come on up here. I don't want you to think it's a Cadillac or anything like that, but just come on up here. I'd like to present to you, John, stand up, come on up the stairs now, you may. I want to present to you this certificate. It's the Congress of the United States Joint Economic Committee, a resolution saying to the members of the Joint Economic Committee, Congress of the United States, extend their sincere appreciation to John R. Stark for his many years of dedicated service on behalf of full employment, balanced growth, and a stable economy. And it goes on to say the wonderful things that this man has done. His 10 years as the director of our staff, and 2 years as deputy director, and it points out that John Stark's unique abilities as a public servant and economic advisor should act as a model for all public service professionals. His kind and gentle manner and his thoughtful guidance have been deeply appreciated by the committee members and the staff. And we, the undersigned members, and John, this is the first time you've had a full membership on anything, and I want to enjoy that with you, hey, bud? Thank you. Thank you. Congratulations, John. I have to let you in on a little joke in a little house, in-house joke. I think it was Congressman Brown that said the other day that there wasn't only a difference between the majority and the minority on some of our observations and conclusions, but there was a difference within the minority of the minority and the minority of the majority and the majority of the minority or whatever it was. We are free thinkers in our committee, and I'll tell you something, it's a special, well, I don't know if it's a joy, but it's quite an experience to serve as chairman. But we put on a pretty good show. And I said today that I thought we had the super extravaganza today when we were able to get Dr. Burns and we were able to get Dr. Greenspan. We had a distinguished panel of economists and business people. We really put it on. I wish you well, many of you were there. And all I can say is I thank all of those that were the combatants and the contestants. It was a delight. Now, dear friends, a moment of serious thought for here. One of the great leaders of our committee and of the Congress is not with us tonight. And I, of course, refer to Wright Patman. The death of Wright Patman, the vice chairman of the Joint Economic Committee, less than 2 weeks ago, was a loss to the entire nation and to all who believe in economic and social justice. Wright Patman was the floor manager of the Employment Act, and he served on the Joint Economic Committee continuously since its formation. His ceaseless and courageous defense of the weak against the powerful, his instinctive understanding of the impact of abstract economic policy decisions on the everyday life of ordinary individuals, and his tireless effort to achieve democratization of the financial system, these qualities will be sorely missed. You know, it isn't so important whether we all agree with each other. Particularly, we find this to be the case in Congress. What is important is that people hold their views sincerely, and that they probe and they inquire to try to be better informed, and that there are spokesmen who will speak up for those who may be speechless, who will stand up for those that can't stand, and who will work for those who have no opportunity. And Wright Patman was that kind of a man. And I salute him here tonight. And believe me, I'm sure that old Wright has heard what I have to say, and I'm not going to give his lecture on the Federal Reserve, but I just want you to know that he really set a high standard for all of us. Let's give him a big round of applause. Too much mourning and sorrow on occasions of the passing of a friend. It seems to me that once in a while we ought to sort of just let the word go out and the emotions pour out of our happiness over the work, the good works of one in his or her lifetime. Now the Employment Act. This didn't come easily. What does it's worthwhile? It was a pitched battle. In fact, one observer described it as the most massive confrontation of our generation over the basic character of the American economy. Now that is quite a description. The confrontation it certainly was. Some people said it was a great victory. But I think we really have to ask ourselves how big a victory it really was. Did the Employment Act of 1946 truly remake the character of the American economy? As with most difficult questions, the answer is uncertain. It's ambiguous. But in many ways, the Employment Act served us well. And I'm one of these people that believe you have to have standards, because it's only that way that you stretch and that you reach out. Without the promise, there is no performance. Without the sense of hope, there is no achievement. And to those that go around this country saying we ought not to promise and we ought not to have standards, I say to you that you are driving the American people away from their natural enthusiasm. The American people are a buoyant, vibrant, youthful, hardworking, exuberant people. And they want to have standards. They want to break the 4-minute mile. And they did. They want to, as athletes, vault higher than any other pole vaulter. And they like to break every single standard that's ever been set. We like to make new standards, new goals, new marks. And if we can do that in business, if we can do it in athletics, if we can do it in all the great professions, we can do it in government. And I hope that we won't listen to people that tell us that we seek to do too much. For those that don't seek to do too much, you can rest assured they'll do too little. And we can't afford that these days. I said that there's some record of achievement here. The past 30 years has seen no repetition of the Great Depression. Real income per capita is 70% higher today than it was 30 years ago. That's not a bad achievement. And contrary to most popular opinion, the greater part of the last 30 years has been a period of considerable price stability. The immediate post-war years, 46, 47, 48, were a period of high inflation, as were the last 3 years. However, during the intervening 24 years, from 1948 through 1972, consumer prices rose on an average of only 2.3% per year. That's a remarkable achievement, considering the building of this country, the fantastic growth of our economy. When we consider that those years encompassed both the Korean War and the Vietnam conflict, the record of price stability is impressive. Were we to exclude those war years and look at the period only from 1952 through 1965, consumer prices rose only 1.4% per year. That's incredible. So my fellow Americans, let's not downgrade ourselves. I'm one of those that believes that we ought to constantly want to do better. I have had a reporter that jumped me not long ago. They like to do that, and I don't mind it. I don't want them to ever forget me. And this fellow asked me, he said, "Well, Mr. Humphrey, you've been around here a long time." He asked me how long I'd been here, and I told him, and he shook his head, and he said to me, "Well, now I want to ask you something. What is your goal?" You know, one of those profound questions. I said, "Well, my goal is rather simple." And he said, "What is it?" I said, "To do better." And the fellow said to me, "Look, Senator, that's not an answer. I gave you a serious question, and you're avoiding the question, and you're not really answering me." I said, "You know, is that right?" I said, "You asked me a question. I gave you my answer." Well, he said, "What is it?" I said, "To do better." He said, "I don't accept that as an answer." Well, I said, "That's just too bad." You see, it's kind of nice to be in my position in life. I don't want anything, and therefore I can be kind of sassy once in a while. I'm enjoying it. I'm emancipated. I love it. The way it just... Then I finally said, "Let me explain." I said, "I'd like to do better. I'd like to be a better senator. I really would like to be a better public servant. I'd like to be a better father, grandfather, husband. I'd like to be a better citizen. In fact, that's what the whole country's all about. Not utopia, but doing better. And that's what I want to leave here tonight as a thought. What we're seeking to do is to do better. Our goal is full employment. It's going to be a hard task, but we can do better. Well, now, when we look at the employment record as compared to the price record, there isn't quite so much to be proud of. The unemployment rate averaged 4.8% the period from 1948 through 72. That was not good enough, but it was a vast improvement over the 1930s. Nevertheless, we could, and we should have, and we must do better. Other countries have done better, and here I think we have almost to be ashamed of in comparison. In the Federal Republic of Germany, the unemployment rate during this comparable period from 48 to 72 averaged less than 1%. The unemployment rates averaged less than 1% during the entire decade of the 1960s. In Japan, it was 1.3. Now, there will be those that say, well, they don't calculate it the same way, but be that as it may, the United States has had the highest unemployment rate of any industrialized nation in the world, with one exception from time to time, that's our sister country to the north, Canada. Now, we in America, proud of our system, proud of our descendants, the dynamic and buoyant and vibrant and strong people, ought not to settle for being not only second best, but third or fourth best when it comes to the utilization of human resources. This country is dedicated to people. That's the difference. The great difference between our democracy and many other countries in the world is that the human resource is the precious resource. And this is what the Declaration of Independence is all about. This is what the Bicentennial is all about. It isn't about some political party or even some particular administration or government. It's about those God-given, inalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness that belong to people. And it was said in the Declaration of Independence that the only justifiable purpose of government was to secure these rights. So let's understand what we're celebrating. Not the 30th anniversary, but the celebration of the Bicentennial is not just a celebration of firecrackers and new neckties that say 1776, but it's a celebration of a philosophy, of a commitment, of an ideology. And that celebration included a pledge by the founders of this country of their lives, their fortune, and their sacred honor. They knew what they were out to do. They pledged it all to establish a government that would be as its primary concern the protection of and the securing of the rights of life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness. So I philosophize with you a little bit. Economics to me is rather sterile, unless you put the human equation in it. We're talking about people. And when you talk about people, you're talking about democracy. You're talking about your religious faith. You're talking about yourself and your family. Now, we've been out on regional hearings, and we've heard a lot. We took the committee out to the country. Well, I know there are always those that say, oh, well, they're just on a political tour or something. Everything that we do is subject to that kind of criticism. But quite frankly, it wasn't easy work. It's hard work. But I have long believed that the government ought to go out to the people instead of constantly asking the people to come in here and see the government. If I had my way, we'd do most of our committee work out in the country. I wish to goodness that some of the people would take other committees out to see the American people. I wish the president's budget, before it's ever sent to Congress, was examined by governors and legislators and mayors and labor and business. Why not? sacred about that document that it shouldn't be, that it shouldn't be examined. I like to always put that punch in because my investigating reporter friends, they can find out everything that's going on in the CIA, everything that's going on in the FBI and in the Pentagon, but they never ever find out what's in the budget until it's before the Congress. That's the most safeguarded document we have. And yet there is no document that's more important to the economic and social well-being of our people. Now, we've had wonderful panel discussions today, and we've gained some new insights. I don't know how much we really profited from all of this, but I'll tell you this. As a friend of mine used to say, and he was President of the United States, Lyndon Johnson, a man's judgment is no better than his information. And I don't think our judgment is going to be any better than our information. The information that we have about the need of capital formation, the information that we have about the structure of our labor force, the information that we have about what's going on in these cities. And let me say very quickly, and I want to warn this audience, that unless we are able to come up with a better policy that relates to the life of people in our urban centers, unless we're able to design an urban strategy, an urban policy that will meet the needs, the economic and social needs of the hundreds of the many millions of people that live in these cities, I predict to you that this country will be in for dire trouble, serious social trouble for the years to come. I'm amazed that there's a presidential election going on and no one, but no one, in office or out of office, aspirant or somebody that thinks they got it locked up, is talking about the problems that beset the American municipality. And mark my words, what happened in New York City is but the tip of the iceberg. All over this nation are problems of comparable nature. Now, for a country boy, I must say that I believe that some perception. And I'm amazed that we don't have more of it around this place. I know we've had recovery to a degree, and let me quickly say that I've been more bullish on the economy than many of my colleagues. Economic conditions have improved. The recovery is underway, and I know they say politically, well, that's good for the incumbent, so be it. I don't believe in price stability at the expense of 10 million Americans who are driven down into greater and greater distress, and I don't want to win an election simply because people are in trouble economically. I prefer that this country move ahead, build its economy, provide the services for its people. The best politics is no politics, performance. I'm here to tell you that if we get some recovery, there's plenty of room for everybody to claim some of the credit, and I'll guarantee you that I'll nudge in and get my share. Retreated before the recovery began, nor how small a beachhead we have established, and how much ground is still to be regained. No satisfaction, dear friends. Yes, improvement, but not nearly enough. If we're to be victorious in the struggle to achieve and sustain full employment, we must be equipped for modern combat. I constantly read in the press that we're supposed to have new ideas. Well, I want the American media to take a good look at some new ideas that we're trying to advance. Because there are many new ideas being talked about these days in the Joint Economic Committee and other committees of the Congress. The inflation of 1974 and the near depression of 1975 are warnings. Very serious warnings that our governmental economic machinery is ill-equipped to deal with the complex and volatile economy of the final quarter of the 20th century. I submit to you that the economic challenges that lie ahead of us the next 25 years are beyond anything we ever dreamed in the past. We have a whole nation, literally, to modernize and much of it to rebuild. Transportation, as was said here tonight by Mr. Abel, millions of homes are needed in this country. But where? What kind? How? How do we meet environmental standards and still have economic development? We can't live on birds and bees. We've got to have jobs too. How do we take care of the health of the American people? How do we pay for these things? Well, dear friends, you can't pay for them on today's income. Now you and I know that we're going to need health care better than we have. You and I know we're going to have to modernize our transportation system. You and I know we're going to have to deepen our ports. You and I know we're going to have to spend billions to rehabilitate and modernize our cities. You and I know that there are things to be done in this country in the field of energy and all these many areas that's going to require fantastic investment, public and private. Now, we're either going to do it or we're going to slip back. Now, I think you want to do it. I believe that the American people want to do better. Then if they do, there's only one way to get it done, and that is to go on out and produce more goods, to put people to work, to quit wasting our physical and human resources, to put them together in product, in service, in production, in income. And once you do that, you can pay for whatever you need to pay for. I'll never forget the time in Ireland that we had our first baby. I said to my father, and I've mentioned him so often, I said, "Oh, how am I going to pay for it?" He said, "Son, you're a little late thinking about that." And then he looked at me and he said, If I'd have thought about that, Hubert, you wouldn't even been here. You would still be a glint in my eye." He said, "The thing that I found out is that when you do something, you gotta get busy and take care of it. And when you start to have a family, you will learn to earn more income. When you have more things you want to do, you earn more. I am not for cutting up somebody else's pie, I'm for making a bigger one for all of us. That's the way we've got to do it." Collectively lack some of the foresight to modernize our institutions. Let me just say I've been very critical at times of the Federal Reserve Board, and I've been critical of the Council of Economic Advisors, and I never try to cover up. I've been very critical of the President. But I want to be critical of my colleagues in Congress, myself included. We set public policy. I attended these Democratic caucuses. And I want to say that I see one thing above all, timidity. We are the elected representatives of the people. Alan Greenspan wasn't elected, he was appointed. Dr. Burns wasn't elected, he too was appointed. But we were elected. And if we've got complaints, and I have had plenty of them, and I want to say it in the presence of my peers in Congress, we better take our share of the responsibility. We're the ones that are supposed to be setting targets and goals. We're the ones that are supposed to be providing job programs. Oh, I know, the President can veto them. Okay, we'll go to the country on that. And that's when we'll have the referendum. But let us have it. This is why Congressman Hawkins and Gus, I want to salute you here tonight. You're truly a remarkable public servant, and this Full Employment and Balanced Growth Act would never have been a reality without Gus Hawkins. And I want you to know I understand that and appreciate it. And you're moving ahead in the House. I commend you again. The sense of urgency is there. I want my colleagues in the Senate to have the same sense of urgency. Now, what is this bill all about? It's no magic formula. It isn't anything that just been pulled out of thin air. This bill is an attempt to modernize our economic policy machinery in order to achieve the elusive national goal of a job for every able-bodied American that wants to work and wants a job at a decent wage. That's what it's all about. It sets a national goal of full employment, and it sets a goal of reducing unemployment to 3% in a 4-year period. No small task. Maybe we've overextended ourselves, some people say, and I will read from the pundits. that we are, you know, that we've gone too far, trying to go too far too fast. Well, I remember giving a speech in Philadelphia in 1948, when I told my fellow Democrats that we were 176 years late in standing up for human rights. And I'm here to tell you that we're late in standing up for full employment in this economy in order to save this economy. There's no time to dilly-dally. What's this bill do? Some straight and simple propositions. The bill provides that goals must be set by the President and the Congress for economic performance, and that economic policies systematically coordinated to reach them. By goals, I mean quantitative annual targets for employment, production, and purchasing power. These must be proposed each year by the President and his advisors, his cabinet, and presented to the Congress for debate and consideration and ultimate action. The Federal Reserve Board would be asked to follow the policies consistent with those targets. And part of the reason we have not reached our full employment objectives in the past is because we're not sure where we were trying to go or how fast we were trying to get there. I said today in a meeting that I remember when my good friend Dr. Burns one day in one of our tete-a-tetes up there, when we were sort of having a good time, he looked at me and put that finger up there and he said, "Senator," he said, "when the Congress gives us a goal and sets these targets, we're a law-abiding group and we'll do our level best to achieve those goals. If we think we can't, we'll come and take it." And that's exactly what this bill provides, exactly almost that language. We'll set the goals in Congress and the President, and we'll insist that the budget, the tax policy, the monetary policy be designed to achieve those goals. And if anybody thinks that they can't be achieved, if the Congress feels they can't be, or a committee of the Congress, or the Federal Reserve Board, they'll have the right to present their dissenting views. But ultimately, the people's elected representative and their president, who are the elected representatives of the American people, will set national policy, and we will expect everybody to get in and cooperate. This bill also provides that annual goals will be established within the framework of a longer-run planning process. This process would bring together all the different elements in our complex set of economic policies and see what they add up to and whether they achieve our goals. Thirdly, the bill envisages that aggregate fiscal and monetary policy will continue to be the basis for sustaining an adequate level of overall production throughout the economy. This is a private enterprise bill, if that makes people feel any better, and that's what it is. The whole thing is directed towards energizing our great economic system. This bill goes on to recognize that fiscal and monetary policy may at times have to be strengthened by a variety of supplemental policies. There's a limit to how much you can expect your monetary policy to do, or even your fiscal policy. And these supplemental policies fall into categories. One category consists of those standby policies which take effect when recession threatens. We call those countercyclical. These include anti-recession assistance to states and localities, emergency public work opportunities for the unemployed, and the systematic timing of public works to offset economic fluctuations. Now listen. Let's get over this idea that we don't have things to do around here. What's wrong with public works? All of it's performed by a private contractor. All of it is performed by citizens of the United States that are working for that contractor. That's a part of the private economy. And we have a need in this country to make our infrastructure, to use a technical phrase or word, better than it is today. This country is privately rich and publicly poor. And I'm here to tell you that cannot be sustained. And we better make up our mind that the time to use the resources of this country for public works is when there is unused plant capacity. When there is money piling up in the banks that is not being used, and unused money is as bad as unemployment. When there are skilled and unskilled workers that want jobs, that's the time to use your public works. But you know what we're going to do? We're going to wait and do it. We're all geared up. You can't find hardly a contractor around that doesn't have 10 contracts ahead of us. And then we're going to say, we forgot to mention it. We've got to rebuild the railroads. By the way, we've got sewage and water plants that we should have taken care of. And that contractor's going to look at you and say, buddy, you're just going to have to wait 5 years because we're busy. And that's the way it works. Now, we are smarter than that, I hope. Now, in addition, these measures include a program for improving, in this bill, the efficiency of the federal government by, among other things, requiring a review of existing government regulations and rules and regulations to assure that they still serve a useful purpose. And I see no reason why we shouldn't do that. And by the way, my liberal friends, you don't prove yourself to be either liberal or conservative by demanding that you see that the rules and regulations are examined to see whether or not they apply to the times in which we live. And also, I want an annual evaluation, as Gus and I put in this bill, of 20% of all the dollar programs every year. And in 5 years, every single program on the legislative books of the Congress of the United States will have to be reviewed from point zero to see whether or not that program is still effective, whether it's still needed, and how it's operating. Now that's really time. Well, now these are some of the elements. I've got a lot of stuff here. Why, I had a good sentence there. Why didn't I tell you that one? Well, let me just put it this way. I know this bill will undergo changes in committee. You know, we learn in Congress if your name is still on the bill by the time it comes out, us, we're lucky. But we have to have a starting point. But I do know this, that the need for action is urgent. This economy does not just take care of itself anymore. We used to have an escape hatch in this country. Whenever we got in trouble, we just went west. We just chopped up the land, cut down the trees, exploited the mines, polluted the waters. We had a lot of it. So why not? Now we have to live within our resources. Full employment will not just happen. It must be made to happen. And that's what government is for, in cooperation with industry and labor. Battles are won by those who are better armed and by those who have the conviction that they're fighting for a just and a worthy cause. The great question before us in 1976 is whether we have the conviction and the sense of dedicated purpose necessary to bring our economy to a situation of non-inflationary full employment and keep it there. I think we have. Now, I know there are going to be arguments about this bill, and I shan't take the time tonight to recite them all. There will be arguments about cost, but I think there are three questions. Don't ask just one question, how much does it cost? By all means, ask that question. But then go on and ask, what would the cost be without it? And finally, what are its benefits? Its costs will depend entirely upon how the private economy responds. If the private economy responds, the cost will be minimal. But if the private economy doesn't respond, then there is the choice between continuing unemployment compensation, food stamps, welfare, or work. And I think I know what the American people. They're perfectly willing to have these programs of what we call transfer payments and social services to a point. But everybody in this country knows there are things to do. And not only that, the work ethic is still alive in this country. And people do want to work, not only for the money, but they want to be a part of this country. John Stuart Mill once said, let a man have nothing to do for his country, and he shall have no love for it. You cut people out, and that's what unemployment is. Unemployment is a signal from government and the economy that you're not needed, you're not wanted, get out of the way. Now that's no way to develop patriotism or dedication. So the cost, well, what if it costs $8 billion or $12 billion, as somebody said, compared to unemployment That's a bargain. And I don't shudder for a minute about the cost. Even if it costs twice as much as that, it's still cheap. The cost last year for this budget was about $70 billion. For doing what? For just seeing to it that people held body and soul together. Now, I don't minimize the importance of old age pensions, Social Security payments, and income maintenance, and unemployment compensation. Quite frankly, without those, I think there would have been turmoil, violence, and destruction in vast areas of this country. We paid a heavy insurance policy, but it was worth it. There comes a time, however, when you have to ask yourself, can't we do better? Now, what does it cost not to have full employment? Well, about $200 billion of lost income and production in 1975. I believe I'm correct, Alan, that the estimate is that it'll be about $1 trillion in lost production between now and 1980. That's money that no one will ever see, production that'll never get to a consumer. That's revenue that'll never get to a government. It's as if you went and put it in the toilet and flushed it into the river. That's how good that is. And I say to you that those that talk about economy and those that talk about waste better ask what kind of economy and what kind of waste. What kind of economy is it to deny this country $200 billion in 1 year? What kind of economy is it to deny this great America $1 trillion in 5 years? I can't for the life of me see why anybody should back away from the argument if it's a matter of cost. I'll not back away from it, not 1 minute, and I'm not about ready to be run for cover when people come up to me and say, oh, these programs didn't work. Well, I want to tell you something. Most of these programs that today are of the social nature are for the poor, for the minorities, as we call them, for mothers, for children, for black, for brown, for the poor, for the elderly. Those are the big transfer payments. And I think it ill behooves some of us who are living better than we ever lived in our life to go around wanting to deny those people just a modicum of decent living. They haven't even had decent living. Now, if the poor people want to come to Hubert Humphrey and complain that the program doesn't work, if the unemployed wants to come to me and say, Mr. Humphrey, your program is lousy, if the black kid in the ghetto comes to me and says, Mr. Senator, your program's no good, I think he's got a case. At least he has a right to complain. But I don't intend to have somebody earning $100,000 a year come around here and say, well, you know, those folks won't work. These programs are no good, et cetera, et cetera. First of all, that $100,000 one was most likely never for him in the first place. And no program will work unless people want to make it work. No program is any better than the direction that it has, the inspiration that it's given, the dedication that it has, and the resources that it has. Excessive unemployment has cost this government incredible amounts in lost revenues. What it cost state and local government last year? $27 billion. $27 billion in lost revenues for state and local government. Excessive unemployment and recession cost America thousands of millions of business failures last year. I believe in free enterprise. Is that free enterprise? To wash them out? Well, I hope this nation, that in this nation we're not so blind that we cannot see the benefits of investment in working opportunities for all who want to work. Many people seem unaware of these benefits, but let me remind you quickly of just a few. We can produce billions in additional income, and that's the only way you're going to pay your bills. Let me just say to any politician that thinks he's going to go around here and con the American people into believing that this government is going to be more economical if he gets in, that's a lie. And they know it. And they always go around saying it's going to be smaller, and that's a lie. Because it doesn't happen. I remember even when the great Franklin Roosevelt campaigned in 1932 and said he was going to reduce government expenditures 25%. He got in office, he found out he couldn't do it. And I've heard them all. And I think it's about time that they're going to talk about credibility that we really face up to it. There'll be $400 billion budgets, and you and I know it. And if it isn't for social services, somebody will have another thing to spend it for. And I don't care whether it's a Republican or a Democrat, there's a certain minimum that has to be expended. And I haven't noticed that there's been too sharp a drop in the manpower of government. If it's dropped off at the federal level, it's picked up at the state and local level. So let's just face it. Government is government. I don't care whether it's at the township or in 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. If you're on the payroll, you're on the payroll. And you add them all up, and the simple fact is there are more people in government today after Mr. Nixon and Mr. Ford have been in for 7 years than there were in the previous 7 or 8 years. And there'll be just as many no matter who gets in next year. I guess I don't give much hope to some people on that, but it's still a fact. We can do some other things. We can dramatically reduce crime and full employment. Every person incarcerated in the state and federal penitentiary costs the taxpayer $12,000 a year at a minimum. You can provide a lot of employment for that. And ladies and gentlemen, I'm here to tell you that youth unemployment and youth crime go hand in hand. And all the people that are wringing their hands about these unsafe streets, and they are unsafe in this city, and they're unsafe in every American city. And one of the reasons is kids are running around, young people are running around with nothing to do. Not only nothing to do, but no hope. Frankly, no guidance. And there'll be crime and crime until people are put to work so they can use their energies in something that's constructive. That's the answer to your crime problem, primarily. Number of people in Congress that are sponsoring this legislation, I'm convinced that it will bring us great benefits. And we must never forget that our economic performance here is watched in Moscow, in Paris, in Bonn, in Peking, it's watched in New Delhi. Our economic performance is watched more than our missiles. If you want to talk national security, talk economic security. That's the only way you're going to pay for national security. We can't pay for the new modern weapons on the production levels of 1970. We're going to have to pay for them on the production levels of 1980. But more significantly, what's the answer to the communists? What's the answer in Italy to the communists? Reform, production, jobs. What does the communist gain in these countries? Because the economic system is rotten from within and corroded and eroded and provides little to no work in some of these countries. Or the pay level is so low, the hope is lost, gone. Our answer to the ideological struggle, and by the way, I believe in an ideological struggle. I won't shrink from it. I think that our system is far superior. I believe in democracy. I believe in our democratic capitalism. And I want to believe in it so much that I make the whole world stand up in amazement and wonder on how well it performs. That's our answer to them. You see, I'm an optimist. I got the right glands. I am an optimist. I think we can do anything we want to do. And I know many people say to me, well, Mr. Humphrey, that's kind of foolish, is it? History is on my side. For all these bellyachers, these prophets of doom and gloom, these pseudo-intellectuals that make themselves appear intellectual because they look worried. They're not intellectual, they just got dyspepsia, that's all. I can cure their problem in short order. The real intellectual is the person of hope and promise. The one that points the way. Not only that tells us how sick we are, but says here's the cure. Here's the methodology. And our economy, like the body itself, has gone through a long period of abuse, and it's going to take rehabilitation. And everybody knows that once you've had a heart attack, once you've had some problems, the doctor gives you a prescription not only of medication, but of the care of your body, of diet, of exercise, of sleep, and more importantly, mental attitude. Mental attitude. The difference between a tired man and a refreshed man is attitude.
not muscle, attitude. What's in your mind? I see more people that look healthy that are so tired they're practically falling over because they got a bad attitude. I got a good attitude. Listen, it's been great to talk to you. We're going to battle around here on this stuff. We're going to have arguments, and I want to ask this audience to form a mighty coalition, spread out. How did we pass the Civil Rights Act in 1964? I'll tell you how we passed it. Perseverance. Never backing off. See my friend over here, John Stewart, who was my partner, my legislative assistant during that time. When we put together in Congress, the votes to break the filibuster and pass that act. Well, we never would have passed it in Congress. Congress won't do anything until you get it all revved up. Congress is a mirror. And sometimes it spends all this time looking at itself. But I want to tell you that if you just get in front of the mirror, they'll look at you. And what we need to do is go on out and line up the governors in every state. That's not too difficult. We go on out and talk to the legislative leaders of both political parties out home. When you're in Washington, theoretically, you can be a little more above the battle. But I'll guarantee you, when you're right out there with the folks will stand up and say, what are you going to do about the fact that in here, in my state of Minnesota, 34,000 people more last month were unemployed. 34,000. As I said today, they say that there's recovery, but there wasn't at home. And that's where I go home. I see folks at home. As much as I love you friends in Washington, I got to depend on the folks at home. And when they say to me, things are not good, Hubert, I get the message. I don't care how popular I am in some party at Georgetown. What can they do for me? That's the way on. Oh, I love them. Don't misunderstand me. Nobody loves a good life more than I do. But let me tell you, we've got to go out and build this coalition. Not build it on anger, but on hope and promise and dedication. And what does that coalition consist of? Every church group in America. Bishop, we talked about it earlier tonight. The rabbis, the priests, the bishops, the ministers, the pastors. Get them all organized. Let them talk to their flock about this. God Almighty intended men and women to have gainful work. That's a good religious principle. If it isn't in the book, we should have added it. Who else are we going to talk to? We're not only going to talk to our friends in organized labor. They're here tonight. Thank God for you. You've been in the forefront of every battle that's been worthwhile in this country, and I'm proud to be associated with it. But we're going to talk to the business people. And privately, they'll tell you that they're for it. Because every one of them knows, with few exceptions, unless he's running some kind of a wheel, he knows, with few exceptions, that his prosperity depends on what's going on out there in that community. How much is that farmer getting for his profit? How much is that worker getting for his wage? There are very few wage earners that have 2 months in the Caribbean on a yacht. They're lucky if they get 2 weeks in a rowboat in northern Minnesota. But I want them to at least get that much. And we're going to have to put together business and educators and professors and economists, and we're going to have to put together labor and church people. We're going to have to put together governors and legislators, and I'll tell you something. If you go on out and do that, I'll give you something to do. You'll scare the living daylights, first of all, out of all the candidates. By the way, there's nothing like election religion. It's better than almost better than salvation. You can do a lot with it. And you can get this Congress to move. And we're going to need some help in the Senate. Because we tend to pontificate. We've been arguing for a week over whether or not we should let corporations or unions make political contribution. I'd like to know what they're going to contribute for and to whom and for what purpose. So I beg you, get out of here tonight, get on the telephone, and when you get home, call up somebody that you haven't talked to for a year and tell them what's going on down here. Tell them that there's some hope. Tell them that we want to have, we want to ask every candidate that comes out, Republican or Democrat, ask them about our case. Ask them what they intend to do about unemployment. Get up. Don't go around and
speeches don't have to be informative and moral. I quit. Thank you very much.